You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA. You know ID in the town all day. ID in the SEA.
Hello and welcome back to the fourth edition of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I am Tristan Caracino. The Caracino of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. We've got a lot in store for you today. Obviously, tons of Seahawks talk, tons of Husky talk, tailgating, the normal business. But I had a few orders of business to take care of before then.
So you have some business before we get to the business.
Before the real business. We're here in beautiful Boulevard Park.
Well, wait, first off, we should mention that we now have a theme song.
Oh, yes. We can't hear the theme song, so I completely forgot that it existed.
We probably should have just played it here, even though it wouldn't be recorded,
for
just
ourselves.
So we would have known what it sounds like.
And that is Slick Watts by Blue Scholars.
It seems like the perfect choice for our podcast is it combines local Seattle music and Sonics, Seattle sports, so it's really everything we're going for here on
and
the podcast.
We're also using it completely unlicensed.
Well, you weren't supposed to say that. Now they don't know.
They'll know that when Blue Scholars tune into this podcast, they'll know that we're using their song and license. Oh, they'll be furious.
I mean, I don't think that's completely unrealistic.
That they're going to listen to it? I think it is.
Oh, yeah, probably is. This particular podcast.
Exactly.
Yes, at some point in the future.
Hypothetically speaking, in the future, Blue Scholars could be listening to one of these podcasts, but not this one.
Because it's probably not very interesting listening for them to hear us discuss whether they might listen.
Whether they're going to be listening. But first, I wanted to say that it's October. It is. It's the month that the NBA basketball season begins. Begins at the end of this month. Are you excited for that?
I'm getting fired up, yeah. It'll be interesting once I actually attend a basketball game in person, which probably won't be I don't think it will be in October, because the Blazers opener, home opener, I believe, is November 2nd.
You're not going to be going to a Blazers preseason game.
I don't think so at this point.
I was looking today, so in Grantland, they begin their NBA basketball preview series with Jalen Rose and Bill Simmons, and I saw that they listed the 76ers as the worst team in the league, and I decided to take a gander at their roster and see who I had heard of on the Philadelphia 76ers.
Man, that would have been a fun show for the game.
And let me say, it is not many players on that team, but I did see that Tony Roten is on the Philadelphia 76ers, former Washington Husky player.
You want to say legend?
No.
I mean, he was only here for 1 year. Let me see if I can pull this up. One of the stories I read earlier today, Roten is the star of the day at Philadelphia 76ers
really?
Training camp.
That was my question for you. Do you think that Tony Roten is going to be getting playing time playing for Philadelphia?
You've looked at their roster. He's going to get some playing time. I mean, it's not inconceivable that he could start at shooting guard next to Michael Carter-Williams, their lottery pick.
Weird,
this year.
Because he can't shoot the ball.
Yep, it would be kind of, and neither can Michael Carter-Williams, which would be one problem with that backcourt. But the Sixers are ostensibly, they're openly trying for the number one pick in the draft, and just if anyone on the team can actually play, then I guess it's like a happy accident or something.
It's going to be a fun season in Philadelphia.
It will be, you know, you just gotta go into it with really low expectations. But anyway, practice was flat, then I thought it got going with Tony's energy. Their new head coach, Brett Brown, said after the third day
he missed
camp,
a lot of layups and then got his own rebound and then eventually hit a layup.
Tony Roten resurrected the gym. There was a spark in the gym with him and it became physical. Also, Tony Roten was the star of the day. He passes so well. He's like, I suppose, a Tyreek Evans type player, a
wow.
big player.
Well, look at that.
So that's kind of been the optimistic scouting report about Tony Roten for the past 5 years here.
I was also wondering, how are you able to pay attention so much to football and also pay attention so much, to, probably more, to basketball once that season starts?
Well, it's the complete lack of a personal life that really enables it.
Well, you've got that going for you.
No, it's tough. Like, I look back a little bit fondly on the lockout season when basketball didn't get started until football was basically wrapping up. That was nice, but
nothing should compete
tricky.
With football. Really, once baseball season starts, I don't pay a ton of attention to baseball up until football season, but once football season starts, baseball is so completely foreign to me watching it. I'll see the scores ticking through on the bottom, and I'm like, that Lions-Giants game is 3-2? I'm like, that's really confusing.
I'm going to have to speak up in defense of playoff baseball. It's odd that you have been a much bigger baseball fan, but I am the only one who's watched any of the games the last couple nights, and you have not watched any of them.
I do not care at all. But also, even when I was playing fantasy baseball and had an extreme interest in baseball during that season, I paid no attention to the playoffs. I could not tell you who won the World Series the last 2 years.
They're very exciting and dramatic, even if you don't have anything vested in them. That's, you know, like I like watching the hockey playoffs for the same reason.
Hockey is an interesting sport to watch, though.
It's a more interesting
sport. Also, there's a team in the hockey playoffs that I'm cheering for in the Vancouver Canucks.
That's true, although that has not been lasted long into the playoffs since 2011.
Wow.
Well, they lost in the first round this year.
I mean, I suppose so. They were in the finals 2 years ago. It wasn't that long ago.
They do have a history of losing in the first round, which makes them an honorary Seattle sports team.
So we've digressed pretty far here. but I also wanted to say that I became a very proud parent today and football fan. This morning...
He didn't become a very proud
parent. No, that sounds weird. I wasn't proud until right now. That's what I'm implying.
Or that you became a parent today.
I have a 17-month-old child, and so he woke up this morning, and we had the baby monitor on. I was laying in bed, and he was talking in bed, and I heard him go, it's like 7 a.m., football, football, talking in bed. And then he said, Seahawks. It was the first time that I've heard him say Seahawks, and he was just in bed sitting there thinking about the Seahawks.
I can only imagine what he was thinking at that point.
How amazing was that? Also, later today, I taught him how to do incomplete pass, the arm motion for incomplete pass, and he learned it immediately.
I mean, it's crazy how advanced he's going to be as a football fan compared to us. You know, we talked last week on the podcast about the first game I attended when I was 9 years old, the first Husky game. He's been to one at age 17 months.
It's true. 16 months, basically, when he attended the game. He already knows incomplete pass, which is weird because the quarterbacks in Seattle don't throw all that many incomplete passes.
Most weeks.
This week excluded. This would be the week that he would learn incomplete pass from Keith Price and Russell Wilson. So that was a very exciting moment for me. And then I also wanted to say, to check in, if you've listened to the Drake album that I assigned you to listen to last week.
I have. As you know, I'm very good at doing homework. That's why I got good grades. I have listened to it, but I don't know if we can discuss it today. There's so much going on in football.
I'll say that I'm not good at doing homework, which is why I got bad grades.
That's true. So did you not listen to it?
I listened to it one time. I listened to it while I was working, and then I was listening to it today while driving around. But I don't feel fully capable of talking about it. I can say that it's good, but I want to do a full review of this album because I think it's pretty good.
Yeah, you're going to have to lead this discussion because I can't be critical in that same way about music. I just don't have the depth of knowledge. So.
I can be critical about anything.
You can be negative about anything.
So anyway, after all of that business has been taken care of, we turn our attention to Husky football. This past weekend, they had a huge victory, 31-13 over the Arizona Wildcats, and really kind of shut down Arizona in every capacity. Arizona's quarterback, B.J. Danker, kind of looked overwhelmed coming to Husky Stadium. He was 14 for 35 for 119 yards, 2 interceptions, and just 3.4 yards per attempt.
It was a game that I think we were very nervous about. You know, Football Outsiders, their college metrics last week had pointed out that Arizona, based on the way that they had demolished an fairly easy non-conference schedule, UNLV was their only even mid-major opponent that they faced. But they still ranked them, I think, maybe in the top 10 or just outside of it based on those three games and some of last year's results that are still factored in. So there was reason to be nervous about this game. And the Huskies stepped up, and, you know, it was interesting. I don't know if we learned quite as much as we would have if this game was played under normal weather conditions. The fact that it was played during an actual monsoon.
An actual monsoon, technically?
I don't know what the technical definition of a monsoon is. If any of our listeners know that, be sure to pass that along. But you could not pass the ball in the first half. And when you add that to an inexperienced quarterback playing on the road in a fairly hostile situation, it was a significant advantage for the Huskies that Danker struggled as much as he did. But where I do think the defense deserves a lot of credit is he's been very effective on the ground through the first three games of this season. And other than there was one play where Shaq Thompson lost contain on him, and he scrambled for, I think, about 30 yards on a fourth down, set up their first touchdown today. That was the only time he really got anything with his legs. Otherwise, UW did a terrific job keeping him in the pocket, making him a passer, and that's where they were so effective. And I think a lot of that credit goes to Shaq Thompson Princeton Fuimono, the two outside linebackers on the edge really did a terrific job.
It feels to me like with where Shaq Thompson is playing, he's kind of perfectly designed to shut down that kind of attack, playing those kind of in-between routes in that nickel linebacker spot. But also, it's interesting to note, Kadeem Carey really shut him down too, 30 carries for 132 yards. I know 4.4 yards per carry doesn't seem like shutting him down, but he was nowhere near 7 yards per carry, what he averaged last year.
Yeah, and from a guy who was, you know, one of the nation's leading rushers, if not the leading rusher last year, I think you feel pretty good about that performance. But I think it does go back to Shaq Thompson. You know, obviously Justin Wilcox, the defensive coordinator, deserves a lot of credit for the defensive turnaround the Huskies have made the last 2 years. But I think a great deal of it really is attributable to Shaq Thompson and his unique talents, because what he allows you to do is, you have him, they list him as a linebacker, but he's also sort of a safety, and he's kind of a nickel corner. He just does all these things, and allows the Huskies to keep their base personnel on the field most of the time, and you're not in a situation where you have to go really small to defend a team that spreads the field like Arizona does, and that's what I think allows Arizona to be so effective on the ground, is they're usually playing against smaller defensive backs, not so in the case of Shaq Thompson.
And then on the Husky side of the ball, offensively, they ran the ball like crazy. Bishop Stankey ran the ball 40 times for 161 yards and a touchdown. And then Jesse Callier also added quite a bit off the bench, 11 carries for 54 yards. All told, the Huskies ran the ball 61 times for 244 yards. And that includes the sacks of Keith Price.
It was a dominant performance by the Huskies on the ground, which was what they needed in those weather conditions, especially in the first half. Yeah, I mean, Sankey set a Husky record for number of carries with 40, and it wasn't even like, you know, as you mentioned, Callier was a part of the running game, but it's just, there were so many running plays, and especially, you know, the way the Huskies are speeding up and getting more plays in this year, that's one thing that they're going to have to watch with Sankey is, you know, you can overload him with carries without even, you know, necessarily having him be the only running back who's capable of running the ball like he was last year, just because you're running the ball so many times.
And how do you think this will, to kind of transition to the next opponent, Stanford, ranked number 3 in the country? Number 5 in the country?
I think number 5.
Okay. Stanford, ranked number 5 in the country in Palo Alto. Obviously a difficult game for the Huskies. How do you think that some of the ground action that the Huskies got this last weekend will translate to Stanford?
Well, I think that's one of the things you want to do against the Cardinal. First off, you've kind of got to be physical to match the way that they play. And you don't want to stick Keith Price in bad situations where he's in third and long and the Stanford pass rushers can tee off on him. That's where you're going to get him hurt, potentially, as we saw last week with Wazoo, where, mm-hmm. you know, a span of 2 series, both Connor Halliday and their backup, Apodaca, went off with injuries. is part of Stanford just coming into CenturyLink Field and demolishing Washington State on Saturday in a terrifically impressive performance. You know, I think the other thing that's going to be important is the strength of the Huskies that we saw on Saturday, special teams. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make sure I gave a shout-out to Johnny Nansen, the special teams coach, because that group was phenomenal.
He'll appreciate it.
Really, yeah, he also listened. He's listening with the Blue Scholars right now. But that group was terrific and a real difference maker on Saturday. You had Kason Williams had a big 52-yard kickoff return. Travis Coons made a 42-yard field goal in just terrible conditions. Also had 5 punts inside the 20. And then beyond that, Arizona got almost nothing from their kickoff returns. Cameron Van Winkle has done a nice job there. So that's one of those things. You have to be really sound in every area to play against Stanford on the road. And I think that's where UW is different than the team that went down there 2 years ago.
So, all that said, is there anything else about Stanford that you want to talk about, breaking them down, how they might face offensively against the Husky defensive front?
Well, it's an interesting question. You know, they're a little bit different than last year's team as well. You know, obviously, as a lot of the talk is going to be the Huskies' new offensive scheme, how that's going to work against the Stanford defense. But Stanford has opened it up a little bit with Kevin Hogan at quarterback this year. It's interesting because, you know, I looked at the numbers before the season. The big difference between him and the starter at the beginning of the year, Josh Nunes, who the Huskies beat at CenturyLink Field in that upset on Thursday night last year, was that he played a much more conservative passing game, much higher completion percentage, but fewer yards per completion. And this year they seem to have gotten those big plays back into the offense without sacrificing that kind of completion percentage. And that's what's really opened up the Stanford offense. And, you know, they've obviously got a terrific running game. Anthony Washington and Tyler Gaffney are two great running backs. And then they bring in Barry Sanders is their third or fourth running back, and he is electric right now. I saw that he probably won't get much more regular playing time this year because of issues with his pass protection, but when he gets the ball, look out.
So it seems like the Huskies' front seven has been really stout, especially against the run. Do you feel like they're going to be able to stop the Stanford attack, or what are you anticipating there?
I mean, I don't think you're going to be able to stop the Stanford attack. I think, you know, slow them down. I mean, I think that the template is, you know, maybe forcing Stanford, taking away those big plays that they've had with the secondary, and then being able to force Stanford to kind of ground it out, put them in a lot of third down situations, and hope that eventually you can stop them in the red zone and hold them to three instead of seven. I think that's kind of the recipe for the Huskies.
Bend but don't break.
Yeah, which, you know, is... It's a little dubious statistically how much that holds up, but I think especially the way college football is going, it's much more valid because now that, you know, you don't have... So much of the game is predicated on throwing the ball outside, quick, short passing, that if you don't have any deep threat, then guys can play up on the edges, and all of a sudden that becomes much more difficult to do in the red zone.
Interesting. I mean, I definitely think that the Husky corners have been great. I thought they played a great game against Arizona, Marcus Peters, and...
Greg Ducre.
I thought they played great games. So taking all that into account, would you predict a high-scoring game? And then also, what do you think the Huskies' chances of winning are?
I don't know about a high-scoring game. I think it'll be an efficient offensive game, but I think it'll be a little different from the past few games because I think that Stanford will slow the game down so much with their more deliberate style of offense that that'll be a difference. You're just not going to see as many possessions and as many plays as you've seen. So, you know, I'd anticipate somewhere around like 28-24, that kind of a final score, maybe a little more lopsided than that. What chances of winning? I'd say maybe 35%, something like that. Looking at this statistically, Jeff Sagarin has now the Huskies rated 7th in the nation if you include scoring margin, which is the better predictor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, only a hair behind Stanford, even though Stanford is actually ranked number 3 in the country, right behind Oregon, who's number 2. And, hey, that's the next 2 weeks. That'll be fun. Followed by Arizona State, who's 10th now.
I was definitely thinking 30%. Now, do you think that Stanford's home field advantage affects the game that much?
Well, they actually have a home crowd now. They
do. Have they developed a home crowd?
They have developed that. They're selling out games this year. So
that's good for them.
I mean, I don't think it's going to be, you know, quite like going into Autzen Stadium or an experience like that, or even Husky Stadium in our case.
Have they historically had much of a home field advantage in Palo Alto?
Not in terms of an intimidating crowd, no.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this ties into a reader question that we had from last week, which is... Katie from Renton wanted to know, how does the up-tempo offense that we've seen in the no-huddle offense affect the impact of crowd noise at college football games?
Yeah, and how much does crowd noise affect up-tempo offenses? I think we both agree that it doesn't really affect up-tempo offenses all that much because they're not relying on audibles at the line of scrimmage and things like that and having the quarterback himself relay messages to the other offensive players.
Well, I think there's a distinction you have to draw here between no-huddle offenses and actual hurry-up offenses, because there's a lot of teams in college football, Arizona is an example of this, mm-hmm. where they don't huddle, but they're not exactly, you know, rushing up to the line of scrimmage. There's still a lot of check-with-me plays. The quarterback mm-hmm. is yelling to their receivers, and especially their offensive linemen, which, you know, there the noise can come into play. We did see one delay of game for Arizona. Still, because of the fact that you're not huddling, there's not the time pressure, mm-hmm. so that helps. But it's different than an offense like Oregon's or what UW is moving to this year, where there's not actually any verbal communication. It's almost all based on cues from the sidelines.
Yeah, teams getting the plays from the sidelines really shouldn't be all that affected by the crowd noise. I mean, the thing about college offenses, I think that with B.J. Danker, I don't know if he was necessarily affected by the crowd noise. I think he was basically just playing his first Pac-12 game on the road.
Yep.
And so a lot of players are going to be playing in environments that they're just not used to. It's not necessarily that the crowd is rattling them. It's just kind of an overwhelming experience being there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's intimidating, let's say. And that's certainly not going to happen in Keith Price's case. That's, I think, one of the reasons why, historically, quarterback experience has been so important in the Pac-12. Mm-hmm.
But I would definitely put in my, you said 35%. I feel like it's about a 30% chance for me. So in that similar range,
Yeah, I think we're in the same vein here, about a 1-in-3 shot. And, you know, if they can pull it off, then all of a sudden that changes this from a good season to a season where you start having realistic chances of playing for big things.
So this past weekend, bears mentioning, USC former head coach Lane Kiffin was fired after their loss at Arizona State, semi-hilariously by athletic director Pat Hayden.
At what, 4:35 in the a.m.?
Yeah, I like that Lane Kiffin was pleading with Pat Hayden. It's like, when you go to the airport to fire somebody at 4:45 a.m., you're going to fire that person.
It's like a breakup. You're still going to argue it out of obligation.
Lane Kiffin is still going to argue it out of obligation. I'm not sure if other coaches would, but Lane Kiffin will.
Any of the Stoops brothers would have.
They would stoop solo. It's a real nice pun.
We'll edit that out.
So, mixed feelings about Lane Kiffin leaving. Honestly, you probably want him in the Pac-12 because he's kind of a train wreck as a head coach. USC has been a bit of a train wreck the last two seasons. But also, there is the fear of Coach Sark leaving UW for USC, which seems catastrophic to me.
I don't know if it'd be catastrophic. I mean, it's possible that if the season had gone the opposite direction, he would have been in the hot seat. You know, just like Lane Kiffin. So I don't know if I go that far, but it certainly derails a lot of the momentum you have so far. I don't know that I have a good feel for whether that's a realistic possibility or not.
I think that Jack Del Rio is obviously the primary candidate, and I think that Jack Del Rio is going to be interested. It feels just all too natural that that's going to happen. I think USC probably has some insane people that they're considering. Jeff Fisher, maybe Kevin Sumlin. Folks like that, kind of the upper tier of head coaches. And I don't think that they're going to land those folks at this point. I mean, Jeff Fisher's not going to leave an NFL team to go coach USC. But Jack Del Rio feels pretty natural. If he passes on that job, and I suppose if Kevin Sumlin also passes on the job and they approach him, it seems like Coach Sark is probably next in line as somebody to be approached.
He's definitely in that tier. It would seem odd for a coach to go from one spot in a conference to another. I can't think of the last time that happened in the Pac-12 in football or basketball.
My perspective also is that I'm not sure that Coach Sark, it might not be a complete rebuilding process because there's a lot of talent at USC, but he's already gone from taking an 0-12 team to making them a perennial bowl team and the 15th ranked team in the country. I don't know if I see Coach Sark wanting to take on another project when he's just done that over 4 years and has become one of the most respected coaches in the Pac-12.
So the question then becomes whether this is leverage for a new contract.
That's what I would guess. Yeah. I think that Coach Sark ends up with one of the insane multi-year contracts that Chris Peterson or somebody like that has, which end up being, you know, until 2025.
Which I don't think I mind, you know, even if there were questions about him, just because from a stability standpoint. And you know,
also, they're not paying the players, so the college has endless money.
Well, that is true, especially now that they're done with the million-dollar, multi-million renovation of the stadium, and hopefully they're starting to rake that money in as opposed to paying it out.
So I wouldn't be too concerned about it, but it's something that bears watching throughout the year, because I do think it would be a major setback for the Huskies losing Coach Sark.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely would not be good.
So we turn our attention to the Seahawks. This last weekend, the Seahawks had an insane 23-20 victory over the Houston Texans. It was one of the most heart-wrenching experiences of our entire lives. I went through various ups and downs of emotion. Various standing and sitting and yelling and frightening babies who were in the room. What were the big takeaways from this game?
I don't know what the big takeaways were, except that
Richard Sherman's takeaway for an
episode. Well, that was the big takeaway. No, I think it's really just we've come to sort of expect this from the Seahawks, that they're not going to get blown out, that even if they fall behind, they're going to rally, and you know maybe sometimes they're not going to pull it off because they're going to dig too big of a hole, as was the case against Atlanta in the playoffs. But you know it's they haven't lost a game in lopsided fashion in a really long time, which I think is one of the marks that this is a very good team.
Definitely a couple things to take from it. I mean, the games that you would most compare it to, and we talked about this, the 10 a.m. start games have been pretty similar, have started sluggishly. So that would be Atlanta in the playoffs, at Miami on the week after Thanksgiving last year, at Chicago.
You can even throw in, to an extent, at Washington in the playoffs. They didn't run away quite as much, so it wasn't the same kind of big comeback. But
I do think that from those games last season to this season, I think that the defense is actually better than it was, especially at the end of last season, where the offense propelled the team into the lead or tied, and in every single one of those games, the defense lost the game for them, except for Washington, but that was kind of a different scenario.
Or at least put the offense in a position where they needed to make another drive, at the very least.
In the Chicago game. But the defense this year, I mean, there was plenty of time for them to blow that game. Honestly, if you would have asked me at the time what the chances of Houston hitting a field goal to win the game were, I would have said they were around 99%. It was just something, and honestly, like, unfortunately, that's something that we kind of came to expect at the end of last season, where on that Atlanta drive, we didn't think that they were going to shut them down with that 38 seconds left.
No, I think we were instantly very nervous. And, you know, I think there are
31 seconds.
A fateful number. I think there are a few reasons for that. I mean, first off, you know, just it's hard to stop teams when they are in that kind of scenario where they know that it's they have to pass at all costs. And, you know, Matt Ryan has done that several times to teams if he only needs a field goal. If he needs a touchdown, it's a different story, as we noticed last week. But then the other thing was, in the playoffs last year, the lack of pass rush was a huge factor in that, and that was very different on Sunday. Even with Michael Bennett leaving the game in the second quarter, you still got great pressure from Cliff Avril and Chris Clemons coming back and playing his most extended action of the season. So that's very encouraging, especially for a team without Bruce Irvin.
That game, and especially the second half of that game, was one of the best performances for the Seattle D-line that we've seen in a really long time. I mean, they're shutting down kind of a pretty difficult two-headed monster in Arian Foster and Ben Tate. I thought that Brandon Mebane played especially well. And then Chris Clemons kind of just returned to form. I mean, he had a sack, a tackle for loss, and another hurry in there. It was pretty crazy that he was able to come back so quickly from that injury and look exactly the same as he did before.
Yeah, and his second game to have so little rest was impressive. And I totally agree with you on Mebane. He was getting so much penetration against the run that really shut everything down, especially once the Seahawks linebackers got into the game and during the second half, once they joined the team.
The real concern there was definitely the linebackers, though. Rewatching this game, most of the big plays that happened, especially in the first half, were because of defensive failures by the linebacking core. And then also, when you looked at the run game, you said it felt like this, and I think the stats bore out also, that either the Texans were being stopped at the line of scrimmage by the D-line, or they were going for 10 yards and being stopped by Cam Chancellor, Earl Thomas, BB.
Yeah, it was nothing in that mid-tier where the linebackers would be making plays. And Bobby Wagner had a very quiet game. I don't know what he ended up with in terms of tackles.
He actually led the team in tackles. He had eight tackles and six solo.
I'm surprised by that because it just didn't feel like he was much of a factor. I wouldn't say that I'm hugely concerned just because of, you know, KJ Wright was banged up in the first half, I think maybe was a factor. The 10 a.m. start, we've seen this before. I mean, obviously, offensively, it was a similar thing where the team looked completely sluggish in the first half and then got it going in the second half. And I wouldn't say it's really something I'm concerned about. So, I mean, clearly it's the Seahawks' weakness, and I think you're going to see a lot of teams target them at the tight end, like Houston was able to do successfully in the first half.
And per Football Outsider stats, the Seahawks are actually number one against the tight end of any team in the NFL still even after that game.
That's crazy.
Despite what Garrett Graham did to them in that game.
Yeah.
So that was surprising. I think I'm not overly concerned about it. We'll talk more about the Colts in a second, but they do have a pretty solid tight end and a really good mid-tier passing game. That's kind of where the Colts excel, is those passes between 7 and 12 yards.
The other thing I think we saw that changed was a lot of zone in the first half, and then they went much more man in the second half and were more effective doing that.
It kind of felt like they had to ease them into the game by playing the zone, and it kind of got them into that big deficit. But once they moved to man, it was clear that everything was tighter. The coverage was tighter. There was no real separation there. Obviously, the big play of the game was the Richard Sherman interception for a touchdown. It was awesome.
It was awesome. I agree.
It was very exciting.
What, the one shoe interception return.
And so it was nice seeing that in Richard Sherman's Defensive Player of the Year season. He may not have actually played that great of a game for most of the game. Andre Johnson,
I think it was one of his weakest games in a long time.
Andre Johnson created a lot of separation in a lot of situations, which is a little bit surprising. But all that the national media is going to take from that is Richard Sherman running 58 yards for a touchdown.
Well, that's going to be on the highlight reel we're putting together as part of the Defensive Player of the Year campaign.
It was also nice to see that happening, the game, not that play itself, happening against former Defensive Player of the Year, J.J. Watt. And really the takeaway from that is just him bloodied on the sideline.
and angry in the locker room after the game, despite the fact that he could not have done, I don't think, much of anything more.
J.J. Watt did everything he could do.
He is... I'm so glad that the Seahawks do not have to play against him for... barring the Super Bowl, in which case I'm all for that.
Yeah, we're fine playing against
for
J.J.
4 years.
But I do have to take you to task for something. So, while watching an NFL game, things are said. People say crazy things throughout the game. Our expectations increase and decrease. We hate players. We love players.
There's wild swings.
It's a natural thing. But at one point in the second quarter, you said, I'm not disappointed in the players, but I am disappointed in the coaching staff. I think you actually said lost faith. You said that you'd lost faith in the coaching staff because they didn't go for a fourth down in the second quarter. And after learning that on that Richard Sherman interception, that was a play that they had specifically practiced for and had the perfect call with Cam Chancellor coming on the blitz, and they'd practiced it multiple times, and Richard Sherman multiple times had intercepted that pass in practice, how do you stand on this now?
They may have outcoached Gary Kubiak at the end of the game. Just maybe. No, lost faith was a poor choice of words. What I was trying to say is I don't think anything we saw in Sunday's game in the first half, even when we were all disappointed, changed my opinion of the ability of the Seahawks players. Because I think, you know, it was maybe a 10 a.m. thing, and then obviously the having three starting offensive linemen out thing. And I was disappointed how little it seemed like the coaching staff adjusted. So we saw a lot of those things then after halftime. But
yes.
It seems like they were kind of obvious in the first half. I'm not really sure why it took until after halftime.
It also turns out that Pete Carroll has faith in Russell Wilson.
As he should.
But you lost faith in Pete Carroll. Pete Carroll has faith in him.
It was a poor choice of words.
Okay. I did take you to task for that one. So moving forward to the Colts for next week, honestly, probably a more difficult opponent than the Houston Texans.
Which is not what anyone thought coming into the season, certainly. You know, as after they lost to Miami in Week 2 after barely beating Oakland in Week 1. But now it turns out, well, I don't know, Miami may or may not be good. They got torn up by New Orleans. That's how the NFL is right now. But in terms of the overall takeaway, they're pretty good.
So quickly for the Colts, they are 5th overall in Football Outsiders DVOA, 4th on offense, 13th on defense, and 13th in special teams. So no major weaknesses for them. Offensively, the Colts have been really good on the ground. They're 2nd in rushing offense per DVOA from Football Outsiders. And actually, Ahmad Bradshaw has really been the surprise player for them.
Yeah, my fantasy waiver claim last week, Ahmad Bradshaw, who had, 19 carries for 95 yards against San Francisco before not playing last week, and he's questionable this week.
I would say that it's seeming unlikely that he's going to play, so that's nice for the Seahawks to probably get the Colts without him. And Vic Ballard, they're down to just Trent Richardson and Donald Brown, who have not been as effective as Ballard and Bradshaw.
Yeah, Richardson struggled on the ground, is kind of carrying it over from his Cleveland days, although that's maybe to be unexpected with so little time to adjust to a new scheme and new playbook. And, you know, they like to play Donald Brown in the two-minute offense because he's the guy that knows the offense the best, is apparently the rationale for that, but he had the blown blitz pickup that cost them the Miami game in many ways.
Andrew Luck this year has been really solid, obviously. He's kind of moved to a more controlled passing style from the down-the-field passing style of Bruce Arians, and it's kind of borne out in the stats. His completion percentage has risen from 54% to 64%, and it's especially apparent when you look at receivers like T.Y. Hilton. So last year, T.Y. Hilton was averaging 18 yards per catch, and now he's down to around 13 yards per catch. So he's there, Reggie Wayne is there. Reggie Wayne is actually a little bit more than he was last year. He's still in that intermediate range. Darius Heyward-Bey is also down from where he was in Oakland. They're really passing the ball to that middle zone right there.
And Kobe Fleener has been a big part of that as their tight end this year with Dwayne Allen out of the lineup up for the season, who's their more blocking tight end. So, I mean, I don't think any of this is surprising with Pep Hamilton taking over as their offensive coordinator. He was at Stanford, and I think a lot of what the Colts do will be very familiar to fans who have watched Stanford play against the Huskies, especially with Andrew Luck at quarterback and Fleener at tight end. So, you know, I think it's very similar to that. They don't run the ball nearly as well as Stanford does. They don't have that kind of dominant offensive line and run game, but the concepts of a lot of play action and intermediate passing are very similar.
And defensively for the Colts, actually their D-line is their biggest weakness. They're fairly solid against the pass, but the D-line is pretty weak. They actually rank in the bottom third of the league against their run, and it's mostly because of that D-line. They run a base 3-4, and they're without first-round draft pick Bjorn Werner for the next 5 to 7 weeks. I would expect that the Seahawks are going to run the ball quite a bit in this game, probably coming out with the intent to run more than they came out against Houston with the intent to run.
And maybe more than any game this season, I would say, in some ways. I mean, you had, you know, Jacksonville was kind of run to set up play action a lot, but, you know, there hasn't been maybe that dominant rushing performance yet this season. I think we could see that.
And if it's going to happen, I think it's going to be this week. The offensive line is still beat up and probably better suited to the running attack. And then we can't forget that in week one, Terrell Pryor really ran wild against the Colts from the quarterback position, and then Frank Gore, before Jim Harbaugh decided not to run the ball crazily in that 49ers game 2 weeks ago, was running really well. He was at about 8 yards per carry.
Yeah, he was just gashing them for big yardage, much as he did last week against St. Louis when they stuck with the run. And surprise, surprise, they ended up winning that game in a blowout.
Oh, that was a good decision. But this really does feel like strength against strength, so I think it's going to be a really interesting game. Last week, because of the offensive line, it ended up being kind of Houston's strength versus the Seahawks' weakness, and it really swung things there in the first half of the game. But right now, it's going to be the Seahawks' defense, which is their strength, versus that pretty powerful Colts offense.
Yeah, and you know, I think that this could be a game where it could be similar to what I said about the Stanford-Washington game, where there's a lot of offensive efficiency. It maybe is not a lot of drives by both teams. If, you know, Indianapolis is using that short passing game and extended drives, and obviously the Seahawks are one of the slowest paced teams in the league. So I feel like that could be the situation where it's teams going back and forth kind of very slowly.
I also think a difference maker could be Andrew Luck running. He's a great runner from the quarterback position. Honestly, he's probably run the ball better this season, excepting last week, than Colin Kaepernick and Russell Wilson have this year.
He's deceptively fast.
Yeah.
I'm really excited to see Luck and Wilson go up against each other. Obviously, they've been compared so much, and to have that matchup, I'm really looking forward to it.
And then before we pick kind of chances of winning, Seahawks get defensive end linebacker Leo Bruce Irvin back from suspension. How do you think he'll play, and do you think he'll affect the game?
I think he'll play. I don't think he'll have a big effect. I think it'll be mostly situational with him in obvious pass rushing situations.
It's pretty interesting, the possibility of having Averill, Clemens, and Irvin all pass rushing on the same play.
There's potentially even Bennett, who might be able to play this week despite that scary-looking injury.
It really could replicate something like the Giants were doing, where they kind of had the four defensive ends and
four
could just
aces.
Tee off. So having those four back, I mean, it's really what the Seahawks were thinking when they brought in Michael Bennett and Cliff Averill. They're like, we're going to rush the quarterback. I think that Bruce Irvin is different from players, obviously, coming back from injury. He did get to play in preseason, which Chris Clemens did not, so he's not necessarily going to need as much time. And it sounded like from Pete Carroll that he was working out the whole time in West Virginia.
Yeah, I mean, I think he'll be ready to go physically. I mean, he's still learning a new position. That's the other aspect of it. But it is interesting timing for him coming back after the linebackers played as poorly as they did in Houston.
I would say that it'll be really interesting to look at third and long plays. First off, who the personnel is. Second off, if they're able to get home against Andrew Luck. But then also, if Andrew Luck gets past those rushers, how far he's going to run for.
Yeah, I mean, that's where you've got to maintain, contain, and be disciplined in your pass rushing, stay in your lane, and get pressure without force him to step up into the pressure as opposed to being able to get free.
So any predictions for the game, and then also chances that the Seahawks win, lose?
I would say like 55% chance the Seahawks win.
That's. I think you're going to be more optimistic this week than
me. That's a first. I'm more optimistic on both teams.
I'm putting it at 50-50.
Huh.
I think partially I was a little bit shell-shocked last week and really thought they would win easily. But it kind of played out the way that we expected it to last week. It just took a long time to play out the way we expected it to.
And, you know, I'm going to go on the record here. I don't think it's going to be another poor 10 a.m. start. I think this time they're going to get off to a better start.
I think that the run game is going to be great. I think that the defense is probably going to be solid. I could see them giving up a few extended drives to the Colts, though. Long drives where they end up scoring touchdowns. And it'll probably be somewhere around a 28-24 game either way.
Yeah, that's about what I was thinking.
So I'm going to put it at 50-50, which is the lowest all season that I would have predicted. We didn't predict week one. I probably would have predicted that at about 60-40 against Carolina.
I might have said 55-45 on that one.
So right now I'm thinking this is probably the hardest game that the Seahawks will have played all year and really will tell us a lot about the team.
You think harder than at San Francisco?
Oh, so far.
Oh, okay. Oh.
Not that they will play all year, but that they have played. This game, I mean, obviously, last week told us a lot about the team. They're obviously resilient, gutsy, various coach words.
grit, I believe, was used a lot on Twitter.
but I think that this week we'll especially know what to expect going forward, and then a couple of easier games against Tennessee, who unfortunately are without Jake Locker.
Yes.
Yes, they are.
It's true with that.
I was really looking forward to seeing Jake Locker play here, and then...
The much-improved Jake Locker.
We're going to be missing him. But yeah, so 50-50 and 55-45.
Yeah.
So tailgating this last week, we had one game to tailgate at. It was a 4 p.m. start, which I think is the perfect tailgate
Absolutely.
Start.
The ideal time.
To follow up on our conversation from last week and the debate, which I clearly beat you on.
Which, by the way, people can still vote on if you haven't voted on.
What is the voting
Which we
right
know that you have voted for yourself. It's a 3-3 right now. There's not a lot of votes, so you've got a chance to really make your opinion
here. Does the 3-3 include the vote for myself?
That does.
Okay. But I noticed this last weekend that we were still drinking Rainier. You were purchasing the beer for our tailgate, and I said, feel free to purchase Coors Light if you would like to.
Let's be clear that the debate was never Coors Light versus Rainier. The debate was, is Coors Light worth drinking? And that's what I've said is yes.
I'm trying to frame the debate as Coors Light versus Rainier.
Well, then in that case, it's not a debate.
Okay, then we agree. But I noticed also...
Great radio.
So the secret importance of having something in the can is... So you have your fancy beer in the bottles, things like that. Is the ability to shotgun beers, which is a common thing that people do when tailgating.
I suppose it is.
It's honestly something that I hadn't considered in this argument for, really not even an argument, in a tailgating ethos.
Yeah, I mean, you want to have some cans. I mean, not that
you need to have some cans.
I'm not a big fan of shotgunning myself.
Have you ever shotgunned a beer?
Yeah.
Oh, you have? I thought you were adamantly opposed to shotgunning beer. I was going to take you to task again.
You've been just harboring all these things and saving them up for the podcast, which is probably not healthy, but it is something. No, I think we all did one last year at one of the games, at one of the Husky games, but no, it's not something I do on a regular basis.
That would be weird if you did do it on a regular basis.
Tuesday night.
I woke up this morning, shotgun a Diet Coke. I did that. That happens. Now, so we had some new folks at the tailgate who were very interested in shotgunning beers. Literally three in a row. And I was willing to participate.
You're not going to say no. That would be impolite.
That person who shotgunned those beers, they were new to the tailgate. Something that they were excited about. I think that they wanted to drink a lot in a very short time frame.
That is why people shotgun beers.
Shotgunned the third beer and then went and threw up. I don't know what the etiquette is for that, but I think it's partially, like, kind of cool that he was so dedicated to shotgunning beers that he was willing to throw up after.
It's a sacrifice.
But also a little bit strange.
I don't think that was the goal.
You can also just drink beer quickly. I feel like your chances of puking it out are lower if you do that. But we had a listener suggestion this week.
Yes, my friend Damon weighed in on the vote with a very elaborate rationale for why he sided with me, and in that also offered us a beer suggestion.
And that is the Bitter American from 21st Amendment Brewing Company. So it's a lower alcohol session type beer. I think it's pretty interesting. Comes in cans, eh? So it's okay for shotgunning. I can't imagine shotgunning something that's not silver. But it comes in cans, so it's perfect for that. It's 4.4 alcohol by volume. I'm interested in trying it. I'm thinking next weekend, when we host Oregon, that would be a perfect beer to get for our prolonged drinking period.
Well, it won't be so prolonged next week since it's a 1 p.m. start. But yeah, I'm looking forward to giving it a try.
But I do have to say that 21st Amendment Brewing Company has kind of let me down. So I've had their Heller High Watermelon beer, and then also the Franklin Roosevelt Fireside Chat beer.
Is it pronounced Roosevelt?
Yes. And I really have not liked them. I think the packaging is great. I think that they're titled really cool things. I've always wanted to drink a beer called Fireside Chat, even as a small lad. I've wanted to drink a beer called Fireside Chat, but it has not lived up to the packaging so far.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think the watermelon beer was kind of a long shot at best.
It's one of their core beers, and it is terrible. It is borderline undrinkable.
You know, I'm going to give them a shot with something more traditional.
And then also this last week while tailgating, it rained a lot.
It was really raining.
It was the wettest I have ever been in my entire life, including showers.
Sold that joke very well. It was really wet. Like, it's funny because our mom was talking about rain gear after the game and talking about how it's going to be like this going forward. And, this is the single worst weather we've had at a Husky game in, you know, I've had season tickets since, what, 2007 now?
My wallet was soaked through 3 days later. I got to work on Monday and my wallet was still noticeably wet.
That's pretty bad. I mean, it wasn't just that it was raining. It's also that the wind was blowing the rain into your face. It was a very unpleasant
situation. We were covered while tailgating, fortunately, but going to the game was one of the worst experiences of my entire life.
I can't imagine if I would have had to try to play football if 300-pound men were also hitting me at the same time I was dealing with those weather conditions.
I feel like that would be easier. You're not as concerned with the weather if somebody...
Okay, trying to catch a pass while dealing with that weather.
Yes. So that it was.
I can empathize with BJ Denker, is what I'm saying.
Who can't empathize with BJ Denker? It was a rough experience. And then fantasy for the week. I had a pretty massive victory over Mrs. Fantasy Genius.
I had the tied for the highest point total in the league.
Yes, you beat me by 1 point. Because Jimmy Graham couldn't come up with his third touchdown of the game.
What a bum.
But it was another solid week for both of us, and another really slow week for waiver claims.
Yeah, I don't think there's many exciting players out there. I do have one waiver claim in, but it's kind of more of a situational thing than anyone I'm really terribly excited about.
To break it down by position, and let me know if you're interested in any of these players, out there are Brian Hoyer.
Well, I'm all for Brian Hoyer.
I'm interested in Brian Hoyer. Brian Hoyer, Ryan Fitzpatrick, Sam Bradford, Terrell Pryor.
Terrell Pryor is not out there in our league. I would be interested in him if he was, because
he's but going up in most leagues, he should be.
He's going up against
available.
The number 32 pass defense in the league, I believe, next week. As he also was, Washington was ranked that previously. But so, despite the time he missed due to the concussion last week, I would definitely look at him. The other guy you didn't mention is someone who I played last week, who's Alex Smith, is out there in some leagues and has been a pretty solid play this year.
Of those quarterbacks, I'm not really particularly interested in any of them. So we had a conversation earlier this week about how kind of that second tier of quarterbacks really hasn't gotten off to a great start at all.
No, that's where both of our quarterbacks are, Colin Kaepernick and Russell Wilson.
And so a situation where we can really give ourselves a pat on the back for being so good with having quarterbacks who are... it's not hard to give myself a pat on the back fantasy-wise. But yeah, that second tier of quarterbacks, you did a little bit of breakdown. But Colin Kaepernick... Russell Wilson. Who else?
Well, Eli Manning's probably in the third tier, but he's another one who's been a terrible disappointment so far. Matt Ryan has been maybe a little bit higher, but he's been very good if you took him. And then Matt Stafford is the other one who's played very well.
Yeah, those folks have kind of emerged from there. Matt Stafford especially was somebody who I was interested in. But it's been kind of a difficult time if you're not in that top tier of quarterbacks. The top tier has been so exceedingly good, too. With Peyton Manning and Drew Brees scoring so many points through the first 4 weeks of the season.
Yeah, I'm not generally a believer in drafting quarterbacks in the first three rounds, but if there was a year to do it, it seems like this was probably it, especially with Manning on such a historic record-setting pace. I mean, the difference between Manning and Drew Brees under a traditional point every 25-yard league and 4 points for TD, he's 24 points ahead of Drew Brees, who's number two. That's the same as the differences between Drew Brees and Aaron Rodgers, who's ninth.
But it's also worth noting that you're fourth in the league in points, and I'm first in the league in points, and that neither of us have had a quarterback who's played especially well. I'm starting Russell Wilson, who's only had one above-average game all season. So maybe it's still not worth spending those early picks on quarterbacks when some of the teams who do have kind of the elite quarterbacks haven't scored as many points because they aren't investing early.
Well, it's the same fundamental theory, which is that, you know, the difference, because the replacement level at quarterback is so high, the difference is never, like, I, you know, Alex Smith is eighth in the league, and I was able to just claim him off waivers last week, no problem. So,
and I also asked you the question, would you trade your first pick, Marshawn Lynch, for my third pick, Jimmy Graham? And you said no.
No, I think that Jimmy Graham has obviously played terrifically so far, but I don't think that he's going to keep scoring two touchdowns a week the rest of the season.
Well, I think he is. But Jimmy Graham is the highest non-quarterback so far. He has 80 points, averaging 20 a week and 6 touchdowns through 4 games, which is pretty awesome.
It's really awesome.
So would you trade, here's another question, would you trade Jimmy Graham for one of those elite quarterbacks?
Probably only Manny or Breeze, I would say.
You wouldn't trade him for Manny and Breeze?
I would.
Or if you had Jimmy Graham, you would only trade him for Manning or Breeze.
Yes.
If you were one of their owners, would you make that trade on the other end, though?
Probably not.
I mean, the advantage that Jimmy Graham gives you right now, obviously, is not going to keep this up, but the advantage he gives you is pretty massive. It goes Jimmy Graham, who scored 80 points, Jordan Cameron, who scored 64, and then Julius Thomas way down at 46. I mean, Jimmy Graham has almost double the amount of points as the third best tight end.
Well, in a related question, is there anyone who you would say right now, in general, is someone that you should sell high on because they're not going to maintain their current level of play?
Somebody that I should sell high on or that I would be interested in selling high on?
I mean, I have a thought looking at the quarterbacks here.
And that's Phillip Rivers?
Well, Phillip Rivers, yes, although I don't think you're as likely, but Michael Vick, just because of the chance of injury.
Yeah, I think Vick is a good sell high option. What about not at quarterback, though?
You know, there's not been as dramatic outliers. I don't think, you know, the running backs who have played well, Peterson, Charles, McCoy, those are guys you expect.
The one at running back who stands out to me is Reggie Bush, also because of just the threat of injury. And also, you know, the threat of Joik Bell playing well, too.
And I don't think there's anyone else that's a really obvious example. Jimmy Graham might be a sell-high candidate just because, I mean, he's so far off the charts.
Shut your mouth. Jimmy Graham is going to score 2 touchdowns every game for the rest of the season.
Which, by the way, hammers home how amazing Jordan Cameron has played.
It really does. I was kind of shocked by that.
Yeah. He's as far ahead of anyone else as Jimmy Graham is ahead of him.
And then also at running back, looking at those waiver possibilities, you've got Rashad Jennings from the Raiders. Darren McFadden is injured, so Jennings is going to be getting a lot of carries, but he's on the Raiders. You've got Tashard Choice with the potential of Fred Jackson and CJ Spiller being injured, Danny Woodhead, Andre Ellington, Roy Helu Jr.
I would say that if you're in position that you need one of those players, you're probably in trouble.
You're probably on 4 right now. I actually think
that 1 and 3.
I think Andre Ellington is an interesting player long term. I think that Rashard Mendenhall is basically done as the Cardinals running back. He's somebody who could emerge as a 20-carry back by week 6. So Andre Ellington is probably the one that interests me the most. Rashad Jennings and Tashard Choice, no interest in whatsoever. Then at wide receiver, we've got Nate Washington, who had a bit of a breakout game last week and a breakout couple weeks. And then also Justin Blackman from the Jaguars, who's coming back from injury. And Marlon Brown, young wide receiver for the Ravens, who's had a pretty solid start to the season.
Marlon Brown, I think, is banged up. Otherwise, he's kind of intriguing. He's got a thigh injury. He's questionable for this week. Julian Edelman's someone who's out there in our league and out there in, it looks like, more than a third of leagues. And, you know, he's not a huge upside guy because he doesn't get many touchdowns, but he's a pretty consistent, reliable play if you feel you need to put someone in the lineup this week.
And not interested at all in Justin Blackman coming off the injury?
He's still playing for the Jaguars. Unless they traded him with Eugene Monroe.
And then at tight end, we have Kobe Fleener, tight end for the Indianapolis Colts, had a touchdown last week, and I think looked pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's going to be, I think, more and more a part of that offense. He's got great rapport with Andrew Luck. You know, Pep Hamilton knows how to use him, and like we already talked about, Allen is out of the lineup, so he's going to be on the field basically every play going forward.
Awesome. Any other thoughts on fantasy?
Well, we should mention, as usual, the Vic Ballard-Jermaine Kearse update.
Oh, yes. As always, we close with the Jermaine Kearse-Vic Ballard update. What's that at right now?
And it's still at 11-6. It was so very, very close to being like 20-6 because Jermaine Kearse caught a pass in the end zone that we all thought was a touchdown. And let's say a questionable offensive pass interference call.
Jermaine Kearse was this close to blowing that competition open.
He really would have done it. But Jermaine Kearse played a lot of snaps on. He was only targeted one time officially, which was at Russell Wilson desperation interception. But at some point, it'll be interesting to see what that comes. You know, he's a very good run blocker, so he's staying on the field so much. But that play-action option is there, too.
Awesome. I think that's it. We're going to go play a game of Madden. We're going to lose. Just like our debate about Coors Light and Rainier Beer.
Yeah, we'll be sure to inform you about that next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.